Hello, everyone. I'm David Monsma. I direct the Aspen Institute's Environment, Energy and Environment Program, and we're largely responsible for the identifying the environment and energy track for Ideas Festival. Today, I'm very pleased to have a session on turning the tide, sustaining the ocean harvest, and I'm going to introduce Carl Ganter, who will introduce our other guests. Carl Ganter is managing editor for MediaVia. It's a journalistic documentary and consulting firm, and he's the director of Circle of Blue. If you were here yesterday, you may have stepped in on that session. It's a nonprofit journalism project of the Pacific Institute that focuses on global freshwater issues. He's a photojournalist, a writer, and a broadcast reporter, and today he'll be our moderator for this session. Carl?
Great, good morning. Thank you for finding us.
You get a prize.
You get a prize. I hope everybody's having a great week here. I know I am. I was glad to find my coffee this morning. We sent our intern Aaron over to get it, and I was looking for it a moment ago, and he said, "Carl, it's in your hand." So thank you for being here.
You're not even that old.
Thanks for being here. Anyway, we have some great minds here, some great ideas, some big ideas to share, and we have a little over 60 minutes to solve one of the major vexing problems on the planet. So we have a lot of work to do. But as Peter Glick said yesterday, if we lived under the sea, the planet would be called water, not Earth. And I had a conversation with Dr. Jerry Lininger, who was one of the astronauts lucky enough or drawing the shortest of straws to fly on Mir for 5 months or so. And so looking down on the planet, he said, if we could bring everybody into space, of course, and I thought back to Richard Branson, maybe getting close, we'd have a different perspective of this water planet that's mostly ocean. Really in this time of growing population, we have greater demands for protein, for food. Our fisheries are in decline and in crisis. Our coral reefs are in serious trouble. We've got a lot of problems on this blue planet in the ocean. And National Geographic had a great point the other day. If we could see it, if we could see underneath the ocean and see the beauty and the real majesty and the ecosystems, we do much better to preserve and to understand what's happening there. Just a quick question. How many of you are scuba divers? Wow, okay, great. So we have an informed group, so with a good perspective. So with that, I'll introduce our speakers here. Mike Boots, Mike is here in the middle, I'll just go alphabetically, is the director of Seafood Choices Alliance. It's a global trade association that advances the marketplace for sustainable seafood. In his role, Mike unites a growing number of leading voices from the seafood industry, working together to transform the seafood marketplace into one that's both environmentally sustainable and economically profitable. That's a big theme throughout the week here, is finding that those sustainable markets. Previously, Mike served in Washington, D.C. as the Natural Resources Advisor to the Governor of California. Which governor was that?
Davis.
Under Davis. He spent more than 15 years working with businesses, governments, and public interest groups on the conservation of natural resources, and served as a senior political advisor during the Clinton administration at EPA. David Helvark, who some of you may have seen last night on the panel on environmental politics, is president of the Blue Frontier Campaign and author of three books that are available in the bookstore here. Blue Frontier, Dispatches from America's Ocean Wilderness, The War Against the Greens, and 50 Ways to Save the Ocean. So we'll get to those, I'm sure. He's editor of the Ocean and Coastal Conservation Guide, organizer of several Blue Vision conferences for ocean activists, some probably new ones coming up, and winner of Coastal Living Magazine's 2005 Leadership Award. And David has worked as a war correspondent in Northern Ireland and Central America, covering a range of issues from military science to the AIDS epidemic. And he's reported from every continent, including Antarctica. So really, here's another front lines, another big battle that David's on the front lines of. And Jim Humphreys down here is U.S. Director of the Marine Stewardship Council. It's an independent organization established to promote responsible fishing practices. He's based in Seattle and represents the council's programs to the fish and seafood industry, retailers, restaurants, NGOs, funders, and consumers. Previously, he worked for Michigan State University, University of Washington, as a local Sea Grant Marine Advisor. He's taught commercial fishermen about fisheries management, developing a pilot project for the collection and recycling of marine plastic debris. I think we've all seen those the really poignant pictures related to that. Coordinated a Pacific Rim International Seafood Conference and created a local volunteer salmon enhancement program. He has a degree in fisheries science from Oregon State University and in natural resources from the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point.
Our hour must be close to finish.
So we're up. I mean, okay. So we're all there. I know, I love these introductions. And actually, I cut these, so these are shorter. So if you'd like to learn more. But what I wanted to do is start with, these guys are obviously very very passionate about what they do, and probably have spent a lot of time at sea or working with indigenous people and fish markets. A lot of things they've seen. So I was hoping they could take 2 or 3 minutes and set the scene for us and explain, use a metaphor, an anecdote that's close to them to introduce us to their passion. And then we'll go into these challenges that we all face on this planet regarding the sustainable ocean harvest and hopefully find some solutions that we can all participate in. So we can go alphabetically, Mike.
Okay. You know, Carl was asking us to sort of frame how we got into this, and I've been at the issue of natural resources and environmental policy for about 15 years now, but I started sort of my passion with the oceans as a young kid growing up in California, and my parents took me to a series of beach cleanups really early on where we were pulling out of the water, and I remember this at a very young age, mattresses and car bumpers and grocery carts, which, you know, wasn't quite what I expected to see coming out of the ocean. And I remember asking a lot of questions about, you know, why that was the case and trying to understand how that could change. And as I got older, I'll borrow a line from Bruce Babbitt yesterday morning for any of you that were out at the Maroon Bells as he was talking about climate change. He said he wasn't smart enough to become a scientist, so he became a lawyer. And I did not want to go down the route of marine biology or something. I actually didn't. I didn't know if I was smart enough for that either. But I thought what was missing from this equation was a real focus on communication, and that there is such a gap in the American public and really around the world with a connection with the ocean, largely I think stemming from a gap in communications about the problems that and the challenges that resource faces. And so I spent some time in government where my biggest frustration was that while we were spending a whole lot of money around government programs that were essentially designed to protect that resource, we did an absolutely pathetic job at explaining to the American public why we were using their tax dollars to do so. And when my time in government was done and I came to do this job, which David described, running an association that's representing sort of the progressive side of the seafood industry and trying really hard to bring together the conservation community who's advocating for ocean protection, and the seafood industry, which is naturally extracting a resource out of that that resource, the communication focus came really back clearly into view. Those two camps have been at odds for so long. And so it just fits so well with kind of my early awareness and concern about the ocean resources and a chance to take people who had a lot of potential to move the market and to improve the resource. If only they sat down to talk about it a little bit more than they had been in the past, and then move really quickly into actually action. And so it's been really great to be in this spot. I'm really thrilled to be here today to talk more about some of those advancements that are actually giving me a little bit more hope. A congressperson on Capitol Hill once told me that environmentalists were the only people that wanted us to feel worse when we woke up in the morning than when we went to sleep. And there's probably some truth to that, but I love the title of this session of Turning the Tide, because I really think on this issue we are beginning to turn that tide, and so I hope we get a chance today to talk more about some of those examples.
Absolutely.
And David, putting the blue back in the red, white, and blue.
There we go. That's a great line.
Like, yeah, I mean, when I was 10, I thought I'd grow up and be a frogman and, you know, fight for dolphins in America and, you know, lived on Long Island Sound, used to play in the swamps behind PS-98 and, you know, grew up on Jacques Cousteau and Sea Hunt, you know, in which Lloyd Bridges played underwater investigator Mike Nelson, you know. So, of course, I grew up and became a diver and a private investigator. And you know, somewhere in there, I remember being very, at Boy Scout camp, looking up at the stars, being very pissed off because I felt like I was a generation too soon to explore them. And then when I was 15, my mom took my sister and me down to Key West. I got a face mask and a snorkel, and suddenly here's like living rocks and all these colors, big hammerhead sharks and turtles, and it's like whole alien world right off our shores. And that kind of was one of those life-changing points. Of course, the blink of a lifetime that I've lived, when I was there, it was 90% live coral cover. Today, it's 2 to 10%. I got distracted by the 60s, went off, became an activist, and then when I realized there wasn't going to be urban guerrilla warfare in America, went to Northern Ireland to see what it looked like. Quickly realized that, like the saying is, you know, in war, truth is the first casualty, so I became an investigative reporter to figure out, since everyone was lying to me, what was the truth, and went off and then spent the next 25 years in a schizophrenic state where I was going off to cover wars and epidemics while coming home to the beach in San Diego and the Bay Area to go body surfing and diving and what I really liked. So I finally got to write, you know, the Blue Frontier book, which was the book I was meant to write about, take my investigative skills, go out in the ocean and look at the crisis, and also gave me an excuse to go visit aircraft carriers and offshore oil rigs and an underwater lab, play with sharks. And at the end of it, sort of a crisis in my life, I just lost somebody who was important. So I had moved to D.C., wasn't sure what I was going to do. I thought maybe this was when the president was ginning up for the war in Iraq. I figured maybe I'd go back to war, because after my parents had died, I went off to Central America, realized war is a pretty effective antidote for depression. And then got a call out of the blue from Ralph Nader, who read this book. Last chapter is called The Seaweed Rebellion. And the one thing that, you know, after talking about the collapse of the ecosystem, why wasn't I depressed? Because there are all these effective watermen and women I've met who have solutions. And it's a question of how we scale them up and create this what I call seaweed rebellion, marine grassroots. So we sat down. He said, well, you know, I'll give you a free office and some initial support. I thought about it, decided we'll probably always have wars. We may not always have, you know, marine wildlife and fish and coral reefs and protective wetlands. Plus, I'd inherited the cat. I didn't know what to do with the cat. If I went off to war. So basically the poos, who didn't even like to get her paws wet, sort of determined my life in the oceans. And here I am.
Great, Jim.
Follow that one.
Yeah, follow that one. I guess my story and the reason that I'm passionate about this issue is kind of rooted in my family. My grandfather and grandmother came over from Norway in the early 20s, and they had come from the Lofoten Islands area north of the Arctic Circle, where he had been a commercial fisherman in Norway. And they ended up in South Dakota, which for a commercial fisherman is not a very good spot to be. And after about a year there of struggling with weather extremes, I think the summer thunderstorms were much worse than the winter coldness for them. They ended up out in the Pacific Northwest, and my grandfather fished up in Alaska for a long, long time. And when I met him, when I was a young man, I would hear stories about the fisheries up in Alaska, the salmon fisheries and the halibut fisheries, and how abundant those fisheries were. And it kind of led his son, my uncle, and me both to educational careers in fisheries management. And I've taken a little bit of time off and commercially fish just to get the experience, because I think it's important to try and get that closeness. But what I've observed is that there's in many areas there's been significant policy failures from government and multinational institutions to manage fisheries. There's not very good understanding on the part of consumers of what they're buying. There's been pretty poor practices on the part of a lot of companies, both on the production side and in the purchasing side. And when the Marine Stewardship Council came along, which was about 10 years ago, the first, because I'd worked for universities for about 10 years, had worked in industry for about 10 years, had done a little commercial fishing, the first thing that popped into my mind was, that's really a good idea. You know, why don't we blend together some good science with, in terms of evaluating fisheries, tie that into a label that's easily understood for consumers, and try and pull the whole package together and use it as an opportunity to create change in terms of practices, both in terms of fishing methods and in terms of fisheries management practices. And so that's kind of what attracted it to me. And the key question that I always like to ask audiences is, when you go to buy seafood, how do you do you think about where it came from? Do you think about what fishing methods were used? How do you know? You know, is there what standards are you using? And how do you know that you can trust the source? That information.
If only there were some kind of label or something.
If only there were some kind of label or something. Exactly,
right.
David. So, well, anyway.
Yeah, and so that's really part of the big story is the awareness, our choices. But that's another question. We've got a communicator here. We have a seasoned journalist and fisheries expert. So, what is the big story? I mean, we're talking about turning the tide. Obviously, we have something really serious unfolding here. And with many, many different facets. If you had to boil it down, what's the big story? What's the Time Magazine pitch from your perspective, from your view? What's the big story here?
Well, the big story is the living seas aren't living anymore. And, and I think the story is the untold story is what I call the seaweed rebellion, the bottom up change that's happening, that people who are living it, who grew up by the water, who've been fishing their whole lives, who've been diving for a generation, are beginning to experience it and respond. And that's where the solutions come from the bottom up. I mean, I think I look at some of the most effective groups like the Surf Rider Foundation, and I figure why. Well, surfing's a local activity for the most part. And so you have this baseline, people who after years of surfing would go in the water and I think Donna Fry, who's a friend whose husband Skip Fry, famous soul surfer of the 60s and the 90s, started coming out as buddies, some of the healthiest people coming out of the water in San Diego with ear infections and gastrointestinal diseases, and saw the water quality was falling apart. That made her an activist. She got elected on Clean Water to the city council. He got involved in Surf Rider. Today is 50,000 surfers in over 100 chapters around the country and the world who are working for clean water and fighting these issues to protect standing waves and clean water. Why don't we have the equivalent with divers? Well, I think it's because it's taken a generation. Most divers, most recreational divers, it's a holiday experience. Most people, except in Jersey, wreck divers in parts of South Florida, mostly they go away, they travel. And so that baseline doesn't exist, except we're now into the second generation of recreational diving. And now when you're going back 20 years later, even to places like the Barrier Reef, you're seeing the real changes. The decline in the reef state, certainly in places like the Florida Keys, it's easy to see things in decline, and then people get engaged, and you're starting to see this with divers now. Certainly.
So what are you seeing when you're when you've been diving for a long time? What changes have you seen, personally, and then give us a larger overview? What's happening with the oceans?
Well, like the Keys are nuked. You see lots of rubble. You go visit Aquarius, which is the only underwater habitat on Earth. It's like our inner spaceship. And you first go dive down there, and it's like, wow, Dr. No, it's a James Bond scene. And, and you get sort of caught up on that, and the tarpon's grazing underneath. And then you go out, and you look at the habitat around it, and it's all reef that's basically, black band and white band, all these diseases that are spread onto the corals. You're seeing bleaching when it's warm. You're seeing the absence of grazers like the parrotfish. And I've seen this, globally, looking at coral bleaching from Florida to Fiji to Australia, where the marine scientists tell me that at the Australian Institute of Marine Science, that best scenario, we lose half the world's tropical reefs to the heat we've already put into the system. So it's what we got to do is protect the diversity that's left and create, these full protected areas. And, I'm about to go off to Hawaii to give a talk to these Hawaiian activists who have now created, I can't pronounce the Hawaiian name, but Northwest Hawaii Monument, named by George Bush of all people, Blue Asterisk. It's the second largest marine protected area in the world after the Barrier Reef. It's the largest. It's, it's 13 times the other U.S. national marine sanctuaries combined, or seven times all the other sanctuaries, and it's fully protected. It's like, whatever its name is, I think it's Hawaiian for Yellowstone National Park, because it's our first great wilderness area in the oceans, and that's one of the solutions. But there are lots of others. I mean, they can talk about, how the problems of overfishing, but once you get past overfishing, once you stop killing the fish, they still have problems. That those, marine critters still have to have habitat. They still have to have clean water. They still have to have water that's not, broiling them away. or too acidic or too you know, too distorted by climate disruption.
So, you know, we're in a world that's demanding more protein. We're in a population growth time. I was in China recently, and just in the interior parts of China, of course, huge water demands, huge demands for food, huge demands for fish. So, you know, here we are. We're talking about sustainable ocean harvest. Is a sustainable ocean harvest in this time of recovery, of needed recovery, is that possible? What, you know, where are we?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is possible, but it's a long path. I mean, the short story is a little bit of what you just described. I mean, the problem of overfishing, which is balanced, I suppose, with the other ocean challenges that are out there, and we've heard a little bit about some of those over the last few days. I mean, clearly climate change and its impact on oceans is real and becoming more and more tangible. You know, issues of coastal development and pollution are still big problems that are going to threaten what people think of as an unlimited bounty out there. But on the problem of overfishing, which you're describing, I mean, the very basic equation which makes this really tough is that people love to eat fish. People around the world are eating fish. They're eating more fish. They think it's a healthy option because it is, largely. And so in the U.S., you know, we eat between 16 and 17 pounds of fish a year, each of us generally. And that number is higher in several European countries. It's a lot higher in parts of Far East Asia. And that trend line is not going anywhere but up. And as you described, I mean, it is a protein source and one of the only protein sources for a good chunk of the world. At the same time, the wild fisheries that a large chunk of that depends upon is pretty stable at about 90, 95 million tons of fish a year. And so those two lines, I mean, it's sort of basic basic geography or economics where they're not matching up. And what's largely happening is an industry that wasn't even around a few decades ago, the fish farming and aquaculture industry, has boomed onto the scene to fill that gap. And that comes with it a whole bunch of opportunity that could fill that hole and feed the world in many ways, and a huge host of challenges that could complicate it in many of the same ways that people who are concerned about the impacts of overfishing are worried about.
New industries always tend to be dirty industries in their growth years, and aquaculture has boomed, and we know it is in terms of salmon farms and the pollution they create. But there's also huge potential in warehouse fishing, barramundi, grow them in tanks. You have 90%+ recycling of nutrients. I mean, there's huge potential in doing it the right way, and because it's a new industry and because we've put it under pressure, there's some potential there. And there's also potential to selectively fish the wild harvest and do it locally and do it sustainably. But
yeah, Jim, can you give us an idea? Yeah, pick up on that and then give us an idea. Where does our fish come from? What's the process? I mean, we talked a little bit about China and what role that plays, even a role that we're not necessarily even aware of.
Well, the fishing industry, first off, is not necessarily a monolith. I was sitting here thinking about salmon fisheries as an example, because everybody knows salmon. And salmon are wild capture fisheries from basically California all the way around the North Pacific over to Japan. But there's a tremendous amount of complexity in those fisheries, both in terms of the gear, not so much in terms of the gear that's used, but in terms of the connection between the land and the water, which affects water quality, affects spawning and rearing habitat. There's a big connection or a big complexity in terms of the fisheries management systems that exist. It's different in the three West Coast states, Oregon, Washington, California, than it is in Alaska, though there have to be, because of the migrations that occur, there have to be discussions about who's catching whose fish, what sort of controls are in place. And then you get over to the Russian side and the Japanese side, and it's very different. And then the further compound it has been the issue of hatcheries and the development of hatchery fish, and whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing. When hatcheries first started, many, many years ago, it was with the idea of trying to correct and mitigate for dams that were going in place. And we then learned that the way that it was done in the early years wasn't necessarily a good thing to do, because genetics of fish were much more important than anybody realized 50 years ago. And so that was a big change. But the fishing industry itself, the way that, that salmon are caught, the Alaska salmon fishery as an example, is one of the largest fisheries in the world, but it's almost all a small boat fishery. And the biggest boats in that fishery are 58 feet long. And I was touring around a man from England up to the Alaska salmon fishery about 3 or 4 years ago, and we were flying over, and he said, "Jim, where are the big boats?" Because the impression is that there's a large harvest, that it's got to be a big boat fishery, and that's not always the case. Now, admittedly, there are certainly some big boat fisheries that exist out in the world, but that doesn't happen to be one of them. And the state of Alaska has been extremely progressive in terms of their management of that particular fishery. They do have hatchery programs, but they've done a pretty reasonable job of kind of paying attention to genetics. They pay a lot of attention to making sure that they have enough fish coming back to the stream so that they have adequate spawning numbers. But the thing that Alaska has, especially in regard to salmon, that's comes right back to a point that David made, is that there's this tremendous land-water connection, and that many of the issues that affect fisheries around the world and affect water quality are as much land use issues as they are water use issues and fisheries issues, because there's this very strong linkage between the two. If you talk to people in the Florida Keys about the problems of the Keys, much of that has to do with water drawdown in southern Florida. It's not necessarily a fact that there's too many divers. You know, it's more a water. It's primarily a water issue, as I understand it. And I think that we have to pay attention to the complexity of some of these linkages that exist around the world.
And one of the nice things with salmon, they're kind of, you know, this heroic, Homeric fish that help you understand habitat. So one of the most progressive commercial fishing groups, Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, is very, you know, they started about 30 years ago. A lot of their members were salmon fishermen. So they had to go upstream into habitat and started working with the ranchers and the Sierra Club 30 years ago. So they developed a sense that collaboration works and you can, you know, work around watersheds. And today, you know, they're working with Maxine Waters and the slow food movement and talking about, we're seeing the return of sardine to Monterey Bay after 40 years. So Zeke, the head of it, saying, why would we have 10 boats taking, you know, 1,000 tons of sardine and converting them to fish meal? Why don't we just have a larger number of small boats bringing in the sardines, and it's Mediterranean cuisine, and we get, you know, we work with the foodies here and develop a local fishery, and people identify, and when you understand where your food's coming from. I mean, somebody said earlier, this is the big problem. People go to the Jersey Shore, and instead of, you know, getting the quahog clams and the eels and the you know, local shad, they're ordering shrimp from a polluting farm in Indonesia and you know, trout from who knows where.
You know, I was also going to just add, Carl, to your question about where our fish comes from. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a really important question, and it's one of the things that makes this issue so complex. That the short answer is that it comes from all over the world, and so in some ways, you know, it's easier to control what is local or regional or even national. But this industry is so spread. And you know, about approaching half of the seafood that we eat here is imported. Same thing is true in Northern Europe. Mm-hmm. China produces a lot of its a lot of seafood that stays in China. But when you look at sort of what Americans are eating, they're eating shrimp and salmon and tuna, and then a bunch of other species that fall right below that. But most of those three species are not coming from our shores, and so that presents a whole series of challenges, both from an overfishing and a management perspective, and a climate change perspective of actually, you know, moving all of that seafood from far spots in the globe to our dinner tables.
A carbon footprint, then.
Yes, exactly.
Sorry.
No, that's good.
Okay. Oh, good. Thanks. I love scaling up too. So So we talk about the slow food movement. We talk about the awareness, which I want to hear a lot more about the labeling too, but. So we have this, the slow food, the kind of more boutique restaurants, if you want to say. I had a chat with Mario Batali, the chef, last week, and I asked him. I was curious. So where does your seafood come from? And he's incredibly fluent. I mean, he said we follow the Monterey Bay Aquarium standards. We and so he could trace it all the way back. But if we go to a food chain, if we go and order the fish sticks at Burger King, or if we go out for dinner at Red Lobster, where does our, if we go to Red Lobster, where does our fish come from?
That's a really good question.
Is it China? Is it here? Is it a combination?
White fish sticks will be pollock from Alaska, which is debatable how sustainable, but for the moment it looks good.
Okay.
But if you go to Red Lobster, you got like Indians who've lost their limbs diving too deep off Honduras.
The short answer is all. A lot of seafood comes from Central America and South America, and the shrimp that we're eating comes from Thailand and Vietnam and Southeast Asia. You raise a really interesting point in terms of the scale of this. I mean, the early work of my organization was largely focused on what I would call the low-hanging fruit on this, which are high-end chefs at white tablecloth restaurants who had the resources and the flexibility as people running their own operations to make these choices, which were not always, at least early on, cheap. Mm-hmm. And so they had some options that other operations just didn't. And what's been encouraging over the last few years is that the world of sustainability as it relates to seafood has broken out from that little wedge, which is where it started. And so you're finding big restaurant chains, including Red Lobster, who are putting a lot of time and resources and energy and money into solving and cracking that nut. And in ways that I think, you know, they might not be there yet, but in a few years, I think we'll hear a lot of great stories about some of the progress they're making. And there are other restaurant chains and retail chains where we all shop that have made both very public and sometimes very private decisions to begin to shift the way that they do this stuff. And I think that not only broadens the equation to the number of people who we're reaching through this conversation, but just in terms of scale, you know, those white tablecloth restaurants weren't demanding a huge market share of the fish that's being traded. And these big boys of retailers and restaurant chains are. And so that has a potential to really shift.
And I was in Nicaragua some years ago, and right after the whole Contra Sandinista thing. And it was interesting because the fisheries off the Mosquito Coast really had not been overfished.
Right.
But this was a time when there were Americans and foreigners coming in and building processing plants, small, but processing plants. They saw a gold mine offshore for the crab and the spiny lobster.
Yeah.
And so you have companies like Walmart and others that are looking at this actually as a long-term sustainability bottom line issue. And
right.
Jim, you can address that.
Well, yeah, I wanted to kind of follow up on Mike's comments relative to some of the bigger buyers and some of the bigger companies engaged, because a year ago January, Walmart made a commitment to sustainable seafood that was, you've heard a lot about their commitment to global climate change over the past few days, but when that commitment was made to global climate change, that it was a broader sustainability commitment and a broader environmental commitment that Walmart had made, and part of that was to source products from sustainable sources, and part of that commitment was to work with the Marine Stewardship Council and also with the World Wildlife Fund and with Conservation International to not only try and source products from sustainable fisheries, but to try and use this opportunity to create change in terms of the fisheries which were providing supply to them. We've been working with Walmart in addition to a number of big buyers globally over the last year and a half, including Unilever, Sainsbury's, Tesco, the Compass Group, Cisco, Metro, which is the third largest retailer. And we've been trying to both identify which fisheries provide the products within their top tier group. You know, Mike was mentioning, you know, shrimp, tuna, and salmon are all in the top three or four. Well, if you look at the top 20 seafood species in the U.S. and in Europe, it's pretty consistent. It kind of moves around depending upon the retailer and what economic bracket they kind of sell into. But the top 20 species are pretty much the top 20 species. And it was really interesting because Walmart actually shared their sourcing data with us. And we then tried to track back and figure out which fisheries fed into it, because even at the supply level point of view, you know, things were identified as an example, like you'd say shrimp, you know, and it didn't say shrimp from such and such, it just said shrimp, or it said tuna. But what we've seen as a result of that commitment, not only from Walmart, but from other large buyers, is that several things have happened. One is that that there's been a significant amount of legitimacy given at the corporate level to having sustainable seafood commitments and sustainability commitments. And that has really gone a long ways towards helping to pave the path, not only for the work that we're doing, but for the work that Mike and the other folks are doing in regard to sustainable seafood. Secondly, it's created a real opportunity for partnerships to occur to try and create change in a lot of the different fisheries. And let me give you an example of that. In the Gulf of California, there's a shrimp fishery that exists that has had it. In shrimp fisheries, wild shrimp fisheries have had significant bycatch issues historically. You know, the numbers that are thrown out are like 7 pounds, 8 pounds, 9 pounds of other stuff or bycatch for 1 pound of edible product. And in the Gulf of California, the shrimp fishery down there was causing a significant impact on a small marine mammal in particular and was driving it towards extinction. Because of the commitments of parties who are interested in sustainable seafood and looking at sustainable shrimp, there's been a partnership put together, and a lot of the funding has come from the Packard Foundation and others, but working with the Natural Resources Defense Council, a group called Sustainable Fisheries Partnerships, World Wildlife Fund, a couple of NGOs down in Mexico, Ocean Garden, who's the largest seller of wild shrimp in the U.S., and the Mexican fishermen to try and create change within this fishery. That type of partnership seems to be happening in a number of different fisheries right now, which I think it's on the one hand, our program is kind of viewed as the gold standard in terms of what fisheries can achieve. And so our program kind of gets put out there as that's the long-term goal. But what are the baby steps that these fisheries need to take? Is it a change in practices? Is it a change in the management system? And in many cases, the NGO community is stepping forward and helping to hold the hand of these fisheries to make those changes. And that's a real important dynamic. We're seeing that in the shrimp fishery. We're seeing it in some of the major whitefish fisheries around the world as well. And I think it's a significant opportunity.
Yeah, and still, again, going back to scale, you got to understand it's a complete crisis. And, you know, Rand Myers, before he died, did the science study that says 90% of the large pelagic fish are gone since 1950. They're not really gone. We know where they went. They went on our plates. But, you know, you have a massively overcapitalized global fishing fleet that has the power. You know, it used to be the fish had refuge too far, too deep. Mm. We can get there. We used all the technologies we developed in World War II, from sonar to to modern satellite tracking, to basically carry out a war of extermination against marine wildlife. And we've been winning, you know, very fast and very rapidly, to the point where, you know, there's right now, we're still suffering in the U.S. from overcapitalizing the fleet in the 1980s, the subsidies we created, the fog loans, the Reagan tax incentive on investment that brought all these lawyers and liquor companies onto the fleets. And they had a boom and bust cycle. You know, they caught everything and then it all collapsed. And we've got built-in conflict of interest even within the U.S. fisheries. So that in 94, they had to close. The cod went away after 500 years. 10 years later, the rockfish in California is shut down. So it's a global thing. The EU is just debating now to end subsidies. You go to the docks in Turkey, all these big 70-foot steel hull trawlers paid for by government loans, and you go in the fish market and there's like little pilchard and stuff. So we're pushing these solutions, but they have to be, you know, global. They have to be global agreements and government agreements and an understanding that it's not really everybody goes, well, there are more people. Most of this food that's being pulled, this 100 million tons of food pulled out of the ocean, is not going to the poor artisanal fishermen in Africa. Africa's fisheries are going to feed West Europe, and most of the world's tuna is ending up in our tuna fish sandwiches. So it's, you know, and as I say, and on top of that, if we solve all those problems, we still have coastal sprawl, the nurseries and filters of the sea have to be protected. So it's a huge challenge. And
so how do we have an overcapitalized fleet.
Hmm? Yeah.
And so how do we break that fishing industrial complex? I mean, and how do we do that? The U.S. has to take a leadership role, the Russia, China. How do we bring all that together? And do you see that happening?
Two hurricanes it helped in 90. Well, actually, it's true. Hurricane Andrew, they snuck in the Hurricane Andrew Relief Act, John Kerry and some others snuck in a $32 million buyback program for the New England fleet. We got to do buybacks of overcapacity. Now, Hurricane Katrina did much better. It sunk most of the Gulf shrimp fleet. And now the rebuilding process is you know, there's serious discussion of buybacks. You know, the 10% of the fleet that went out last year did great. And they're doing it at a scale that might be sustainable.
I think also what's happening is there's some level of creativity around, not necessarily these big tanker, these big trawlers, but, you know, as the industry shifts and around the world changes both from wild fisheries to aquaculture and other changes are happening, you know, I think companies, governments, private investors are looking at ways to leverage the infrastructure that went into wild fishing to support what's going to be an aquaculture infrastructure that's largely not built yet. And so that's true from old rigs, and it's true from boats that are no longer being used, and it's true for fishermen who in many places have lost their jobs because of this overcapitalization and the resources dwindling. And so part of it, I think, is an infrastructure question. Part of it is going to be a government question and a regulatory one. And there are, you know, the U.S. government has had, you know, moves forward and moves backward on that front. There are other governments, like in Iceland and in New Zealand and other places, that have that are really making forward strides and linking up this market stuff that we've been talking about with a really sound policy connection. Because I think what we've maybe done in the past is rely on one or the other and not enough complementary work between the two. So
yeah. Let me give two examples of things that work, that have worked, because a third's here. One is Cedar Key, Florida. Beautiful little island about 3 hours north of Tampa. And you get out there, and it's about the permanent residents, about half are retired professors from Tallahassee, the other half are from Gainesville, the other half are ex-mullet fishermen. And back when they were mullet fishermen, they were all gung-ho for developing the island and bringing in more. They banned mullet fishing in Florida a few years ago. And what the state did to compensate the guys on Cedar Key is there's a lot of state waters there. They opened it up to clam fishing. Shellfish aquaculture, they take the nutrients out of the water. It's a great form of aquaculture. These guys have all shifted from fishing mullet and dragging nets and pulling a lot of bycatch to raising shellfish. And now they're very concerned about water quality, and now they're like a big part of the coalition to keep the developers off their island. So, you know, there's these very, and on the global scale, we used to have in the 1980s and early 90s, the high seas drift net fleet, Asian fleet, going for squid, but taking everything out of the water. I mean, literally, nets 40 miles long, 1,000 fleet, there'd be 40,000 miles of drift net in the North Pacific, wiping out the ecosystem. Among those drift netters that went on for a decade, about 10% of them were pirates. They were stealing salmon. And there are treaty agreements between the U.S., Japan, and Russia that the salmon belong to those nations. You don't take them on the high seas. So these fish cops discovered high seas drift net salmon being shipped around the Northwest and Bellingham, among other places. And the U.S. signed up with Australia and others, and the U.N. banned high seas drift nets. And today I go fly out with the Coast Guard, and they're looking for the one or two drift netters who are cheating. That 1,000 ship fleet's banned. And, you know, this is like, so if you have big factory trawlers, we have a precedent. If we have methods of fishing that are destroying the ecosystems, we've had an international agreement that got rid of them in the past. We can get rid of them in the future. We can work together.
Jim,
In terms of how to solve the issue, I think it's going to take some regulatory changes at the state, national, and international level. But I also think that some of the pressure coming from the large corporations who are buyers, whether it's Red Lobster, Walmart, Unilever, and companies like that who are engaged, is going to help to play a significant role in driving that change forward. And what I see happening from the industry side is that there are conversations happening now that weren't happening 5 years ago, and that there are demands being placed on fisheries to make changes that those demands didn't exist 5 years ago, and that if changes are not made, that basically the companies are saying you're going to have to change your practices. And again, whether or not it's a fishing practice issue or a regulatory issue, and get your get your fishery in order, or we will take our business elsewhere. And that elsewhere may be maybe an aquaculture choice. It might be a different fishery that they're looking to purchase from. But but I think that buyer pressure is going to play a big role in this.
And what does that? Two questions. One, what is that when we see it? When we see a label, a sustainable fished label, what does that mean? And also, is there an education program that people actually understand that and are looking for that?
Okay. The label itself, whenever you have an eco label, the key question is what's the standard?
Right.
And so our standard really reflects three main things. Are the fish stocks healthy? What's the impact of the fishery on the ecosystem? And does the fishery have an effective fisheries management system? And so all three of those issues get looked at. Now, because we're truly a labeling program, there are some international criteria that we have to adhere to and things that we have to do that make our process kind of complex and long. But at the end of the day, our process is a scientifically driven process that's peer-reviewed that looks at fisheries on a fishery-by-fishery basis. And then at the tail end of it, if a fishery meets our standard, then those products qualify to use our label, but there has to be a traceability system in place to show that when that label went on the product, that it actually came from a fishery that was certified. So if you go into Whole Foods, as an example, who's supported our program for a long, long time, and you see a smoked Alaska salmon product that has our label on it, that the Alaska salmon fishery has been certified, and you can be pretty well assured that that product actually came from that fishery as opposed to having come from Russia or being farm fish or coming from Hokkaido or something like that.
So, Mike, the communication side, then how do we make sure that people are looking for that?
Yeah, I was going to agree with what Jim said, but also it highlights one fix to a huge and complex problem, and the global nature that we were talking about of this industry adds another layer of complexity. I mean, the MSC program is global and has products labeled in a host of countries around the world, which is fantastic, and has a reach that is growing every month, which is wonderful. The tricky part is their focus is on wild fisheries, and so as this aquaculture side of things, as the industry grows, there's a gap there. There's also competing labels for the wild fishery side of things. So when you come to the communications side of things, what you're left with is a really confusing picture for the consumer. And there are a variety of labels for wild fish. There are a variety of labels popping up, some company-driven, some government-driven, some association-driven for farmed fish. And at the end of the day, a consumer has, 23 seconds in a grocery store aisle to pick out what they're looking for before they head on to the next thing. And so we are struggling, I think, collectively as a community and as an industry to try to bring that clarity to the marketplace because it simply doesn't exist right now. To step back one other way, I mean, I think what's missing is some kind of very big marketing advertising program, which costs a lot of money to do. But those labels that are out there in the market that have a lot of resonance, whether they're fair trade labels on coffee or they're the dolphin safe label or on tuna, consumers know about them because they've seen them a lot. And part of the struggle for the MSC is to get that logo in front of a lot of people so that they see the little fish and instantly associate it to mean all the things that Jim just described.
And then make sure we have the watchdogs to keep the integrity level high.
Right. And just what the public most responds to, of course, is public health. So to throw in the mix, the predators we like to eat, like tuna and swordfish, also bioaccumulate the toxins, and so you have mercury labels. And only in the last few years, the people labeling for sustainability also mix in the labeling for health. And the other option which people have, I piss off friends when I suggest it, is if you don't know, buy an organic chicken instead. I mean, you don't have to eat fish. One of the things that strikes me is kind of every marine conservation meeting has to be piles of sustainable seafood, And that's good education, but come on, it's like the forest movement doesn't have big bonfires at all their events.
Jim wants to respond to that, and then we'll take some questions too.
I just wanted to kind of build on what Mike had said in regards to getting the word out to consumers, because we're an international nonprofit, and we have a small staff and a big remit, and so we've tried to get the word out through the companies that are using our label, and We've had much better success, and our program is much further along in terms of reaching consumers in Europe than it is here in the U.S. And just last week, I saw a flyer that was sent out from a company called Lidl, which is in, it's L-I-D-L, which is in Germany. And they're a retailer kind of like Target or Walmart, except they operate in the German market. And they sent out their regular weekly flyer, you know, which you know, is their ad flyer, to 20 million people. And the whole back page was devoted to the Marine Stewardship Council and sustainable seafood. So while we're not able to generate our own publicity and advertising, we are able to tie in with some of these large commercial efforts and ride on their coattails. And in the long term, that's how we're going to build this message. But the other thing I wanted to point out is that, and Carl and I were talking about this the other day, that we have a language issue, you know. And my background has been in the fishery and as a on the science side for a long, long time. And I hired a communications person who came from television. And about 2 weeks into the job, she said, "Jim, you got to quit talking the way you're talking." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, nobody in the real world knows what the word fishery means." And it's like, and if you're in the field, it's a very specific, defined word. But if I throw out the word fishery to you, to some of you, it means the trout fishery that you go and the small little stream. It might mean the fish farm that you know that you think your salmon comes from. It might be the entire collection of getting cod to the market. And so, in terms of our communicating that message, we have to, I think, develop some clarity in terms of how we communicate these issues.
So we got a question.
Yes. Yes. And gentleman back here, if you could give us your name and.
Yeah. My name is Tom McCluskey, and I'm chairman of Kona Blue Water Farms in Kona. And we are a sustainable offshore open ocean aquaculture business. And and I'm in the private equity business. I've been in three agriculturally based businesses. The last business I was involved in, we started the organic dairy business in the United States. And our first year, we had $400,000 in sales. Last year, we had $400 million in sales. So, our premise was that if you could take a commodity, fish, milk, whatever, and convert it into something that people could recognize and have confidence in the quality of the product and where it came from, that you'd be successful. And we were able to do that in the dairy business. We think we can do that in the aquaculture business. My take on this is that the overfishing of the oceans is purely economics driven. And that what we need to do as a society is come up with alternatives. Aquaculture, the way we do it, which is very sustainable, we test, we're very careful, no mercury, no PCBs, nothing. The challenge is that the government doesn't really do anything to support open ocean aquaculture. They do a lot to support the big fishing fleets. So if the society decides that we want to transition from going out and just fishing the oceans to where there's nothing left, to going out in a responsible way, farming fish that are safe. We know exactly what went into the fish, we know the waters that the fish are grown in. The government's got to get behind that. And the way the government's going to get behind that is if you guys tell the government to get behind that, or lobby for the government to get behind that. Our challenge, and the challenge in the dairy business, was to make it profitable. And once it's profitable, it's a sustainable industry at that point. Aquaculture is very profitable, but it's not sustainable. In other words, I could save 30% of my profits by not doing it in a sustainable way. Our company isn't committed to doing that. Our company is committed to doing it in a sustainable way. And we are just about at the point after 6 years where it's going to be profitable and we're going to expand it to other parts of the world. But I can tell you that we have had virtually, other than a lot of lip service, which has been great. We've had the Secretary of Commerce out to our farm. He says it's terrific, blah, blah, blah. But that's about all we get. So if the government is willing to step up and say, we need to make some changes in the way that we farm fish or open ocean fish, I think you'll have a whole new industry crop up that's both sustainable, profitable, healthy, good for the environment, and everything that you guys want to hear. But
well, I wrote about your industry and Popular Mechanics about a year and a half ago, and actually I've seen your nets from the natural, when I was visiting the natural energy lab there, your offshore there. But you know, the problem, so you get a visit by Guterres, who's head of commerce, and NOAA, the main ocean agency, is sunk within the Department of Commerce. Guterres' background is a CEO of Kellogg, so if the oceans were made of cereal, he'd be the right guy for the job. But well, and what I like is you know, the fish meal issue is big. You know, you say, well, we're down to, you know, whatever, 2 pounds to one, but that's dry to wet fish, how many pounds to concentrate. But I like, you know, what you're doing. You're going offshore, which removes some of the nutrients issues from inshore, and you're starting to look at ways, energy conversion, where you're not taking more energy in the meal into the fish. There was a bill proposed out of NOAA that said to support offshore aquaculture, but it was one of these things that was like, that had no reference to the environmental issues that have to be dealt with. And I know your company, your best business practices, you'd meet those standards. There were no standards. It was basically put money and trust NOAA. And somehow the environmental movement felt trusting the Bush administration to figure out the environmental regulations wasn't going to work.
I was
so now, you know, we're going to see it. And again, we're going to see it hopefully sooner because we have, you know, the industry is growing huge, the aquaculture industry. And right now it's mostly offshore. It's mostly, you know, mangroves being taken out in Aceh province. And they did, you know, science did one of these, you know, let's study the obvious studies. And they found that the areas in Aceh province that had the shrimp farms, the towns were wiped out. And where the mangroves were intact, the town survived the tsunami. So obviously we need to move to domestic sustainable aquaculture relatively quickly.
I was just going to say, Kona Blue's been a member of the Alliance for a while. They've been a wonderful participant. And those are the kinds of stories that we like to showcase, because I think in an otherwise young industry where there's a lot of criticism about what is and isn't happening, you guys have distinguished yourself and been incredibly transparent in how you're building this out. What I was also going to say was a little bit of echoing Dave, that there was a summit on aquaculture about 2 weeks ago that NOAA held. People from Kona Blue were there. I was there, a host of companies. Around this challenge of open ocean aquaculture, and to try to, I think, build some momentum into the next round of legislation that failed miserably last year, has been revised and has now been reintroduced into the House and the Senate. And I hope they're moving more in the providing greater clarity around the environmental regulation piece up front than they did the last time around, because that's certainly what caused it to stumble. But there was a lot of discussion at that meeting about competitiveness and about the capital that needs to be invested by private equity firms in the U.S. to make the U.S. aquaculture, offshore aquaculture industry grow, and to really think hard about what species we're going to grow in the U.S. that will differentiate our industry from those that are happening around the world. Because most other countries have opened up their shores and offshores to this kind of industry, and the U.S. hasn't. But the species that the industry largely wants to farm here in the U.S. are really capital intensive, you know, big. They're not sort of ones for fish feed that will go to the developing world, but they're salmon and tuna and all these other species that cost a lot of money. And so it's a big.
Now let me just throw in a quick pitch, which is next summer we're going to try and do another ocean summit. We did one in 2004 with about 250 people from 170 groups, and we're hoping to get 1,000 this time too. Part of it is just dialoguing, you know, to get the ocean energy people and sustainable aquaculture talking to the marine conservation, talking to the commercial fishing progressive elements. I just got a call from the ILWU, the longshoremen, saying it's a great coalition, but there's a big gap. I said, that's you. That's maritime labor. They're working to clean up the ports. Barbara Boxer's reintroducing her Comprehensive Oceans Act. And I think, you know, what we need in the U.S. is an Oceans Act, an American Oceans Act at the level of the Clean Air and the Clean Water Act of the 70s, so that there is this constituency gets to express itself and move legislation that changes things at a comprehensive level. We've had two major ocean commissions that have said we need this, and it's being acted on at a state level in some regions, but we need to, as I say, scale up these solutions to the national level and then hopefully the global.
All right, we had a question here.
Maybe I should have gone first, but about a decade ago, you started hearing about fish farming, and it sounded like a panacea and a great idea. And you know, then the information started coming out that it was absolutely terrible for the environment. And the studies started coming out saying that the fish fish was nowhere near as nutritionally beneficial, and in some cases actually much worse for you. And so don't buy farmed fish, buy wild salmon, talking about salmon in particular. I've read a bunch of reports about how you shouldn't eat farmed salmon. So, I mean, you had discussed there's new things coming on, and obviously you guys are doing it. I guess, is all that true? Is the farming going to evolve to the point where it's...
It's a good question. I think the quick answer is that not all aquaculture is equal. And so a lot of what you've been talking about is the story of salmon, of farmed salmon, which has been sort of the poster child of bad aquaculture. And so there's been a lot of press since it has really gained steam, not really in the U.S., but in Canada and Chile and Norway, where it's primarily farmed, for all those environmental and health reasons. And, you know, there are people on both sides of that question who will argue till they're blue in the face about, you know, how good or bad that product is and how good or bad that system is. But there are operations that are doing things differently and are innovating incredibly right now, given that they see this huge potential in growth for that sector of the industry that is changing this. You know, what it looked like a year ago today is nothing what it looks like today, and it won't look like that a year from now. I think the challenge is around two issues. One is around escapes of these farmed fish into the wild to intermix genetically with wild fish. And so finding the right technology to prevent that is a big concern. And a big area of focus in research dollars. And the other is around feed, which we've talked a little bit about, you know, using a bunch of wild fish, putting a further strain on the ocean to feed this farm fish. And there's a lot of great companies who talk about innovation are spending a lot of resources and time and energy to find alternatives to that vegetarian-based feed that won't require that. And so those two developments, I think, will lead to clean aquaculture as more the rule than the exception in the not-too-distant future.
And what you really just... Your question was sort of great, but it's like, is agriculture good or bad? You know, the answer is yes. I mean, the only difference is that we shouldn't have called the seas harvest, because we don't really harvest in the sense of agriculture. We're still, this is the last great hunter-gatherer activity on the last great commons. And what we have to do with wild fisheries is understand that, one, it's a commons, belongs to all of us, and two, that it's really marine wildlife, and that we have to treat it as part of our last great wilderness range. So that the fish we take out, we have to understand them in terms of a complex of a wilderness ecosystem. And so, you know, we have a limited number we can take out of the wild, and then we develop, you know, feedlots that aren't feedlots, that are more like organic farming, that you have good, you know, blue harvesting. But also recognizing that there's still a chance, you know, it's not every nation that gets a second chance on a wild frontier. There's still enough intact wilderness out there that we could restore it, and we could have, you know, great wilderness ranges in the sea, and that fishing's a part of that larger, you know, marine wilderness. I mean, I just moved back to California, and part of the thrill is that with all the problems in the fisheries, it's still intact enough that we're seeing big pinnipeds and elephant seals come back. That's bringing a healthy population of white sharks, which is problematic in a sense for me as a recreational water user, but you know, I just go back to Ed Abbey saying, you know, if there's not something bigger and meaner than you are out there, it's not really wilderness. You know, we still have wilderness.
Just one follow-up to that. We talked about Walmart following safe practices. Is there, when you go into Walmart, most of their salmon is farmed salmon or is not wild salmon. Are they moving towards supporting sustainable farm fishing?
Yes.
You want to talk about that?
Well, from the wild capture side, seasonally and in their frozen and canned products, they do have products primarily from the Alaska fishery, but they also buy from some of the other areas, and they're working with those fisheries to improve their practices.
And on the aquaculture side of things, there's something called the Global Aquaculture Alliance, which is not sort of as independent, third-party certifiable as the MSC is for wild fish, but it's the one that has the most traction here in the U.S., and Walmart buys its salmon in accordance with that. But it has under a lot of pressure from conservation groups committed to trying to green that process more than it currently is.
Blew it.
Yes, right.
The melting of ice caps, the melting of glaciers around the world, rising ocean levels, is that a good or a bad thing for the ocean?
Well, I mean, fast I could say, well, hell, we're, you know, our constituency, our area, it's going to go from 71% to 72%. So, but no, it's having incredibly disruptive effects. You know, we're seeing, I mean, in the Arctic, for example, along with the polar bears, you're losing a whole ecosystem. My friend Kathy Crane at NOAA is actually doing, she's now up there with the Coast Guard icebreakers and stuff. And what they're trying to do is document the under ice ecosystem before it goes away. And then, of course, the IMO, the International Maritime Organization, is looking that they could cut, shipping could cut 40% of its fuel cost by going over the top through the Northwest Passage between Asia and Europe instead of around the Cape. So now you're going to have, you know, I just talked, or was it a press thing with the Chief of Naval Operations, head of the Coast Guard, and head of the Marines, and said, you know, what's the war-fighting environment in an ice-free Arctic? They're looking at that. They're looking at controlling shipping, pollution, terrorism. In a new environment. It's, you know, we're doing a big chemistry experiment on the planet, and guys like John Fund from the Wall Street Journal may say they're winners and losers, but the problem is we don't know how many losers, and you know, they're not just going to be our species.
I think in follow-up to that, the answer to your question is that it's going to change, and we don't know exactly what the change is going to be. Ocean ecosystems are very temperature-dependent. And minor temperature changes, a degree or two, can have significant impacts upon the species mix and the productivity and some of the energy cycles that are existing within some of the oceans. And so I think we're going to see some significant shifts. Yeah, I mean, traditionally we saw these sorts of shifts, you know, I mean, just in the fishery off the West Coast as an example, in terms of how close the albacore tuna would come to shore, near shore every year. If we had the currents and they were running warm, they'd get close to shore. If the currents were running cold, they'd be 200 miles offshore. That's kind of a natural phenomenon. But when you have the whole system increasing by a few degrees, there's going to be some significant changes. That's going to further stress both the regulatory regimes and it's going to create change within the fishing communities. And depending upon if production of the fish stocks go up or goes down, it could have profound impacts.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, you know, you see this coral, it's wedding cake white from bleaching. Corals are, you know, massive structures, but they're very sensitive. They've got 7 requirements in terms of low nutrient water, certain water clarity, and their temperature range, it's very narrow. So in 97, 98, you've already seen the global ocean, warm 1 degree and expand. And then when you had the El Nino phenomena, you saw the first global bleaching, where essentially when it gets warm, little polyps or living critters on the top of the calcium carbonate structures. Zooxanthella algae, they get like 30% of their energy taking food out that they grab that passes. The other 70% comes in a symbiotic relationship with the algae. When it gets warm, the algae seems to turn toxic. They expel it, lose all their color, turn white, and if the doldrums last long enough, they die. And even the year after, the ones that survive, their reproduction is only 40% a year out, 80% 2 years out. It takes 3 years to come back to the reproductive cycle. So, you know, it's like I say, it's scary stuff we're doing out there, and we only hope that the frustrations, we got the solutions, 50 ways to save the ocean, that we all have, you know, and it has to be start with us as citizens and consumers, and understand that people, I wrote that a lot because people would come up after I talk about the Blue Frontier, they say, what can I do as an individual? I got a family, I got a job. It's like you're already doing something. You're already having impact on the seas around us. It's being conscious of what they are and making the choices. Whether it's, you know, buying a MSC labeled seafood or, you know, using less plastic, joining a beach cleanup, starting a sustainable, you know, aquaculture program, whatever it is, company.
And land use. We have time for maybe, we end, what, a quarter to?
One more question, please.
Matthias.
There's quite a lot of research pointing to that in order to have sustainable fisheries, quite large areas would need to be set aside for protected areas, like up to a third or something. Does MSC or other initiatives make that as a requirement for labeling? Because that's quite, I mean, significant. significant struggle to put so much area under the roof?
Yeah, there's not a specific numerical requirement. And in general, the idea of ecosystem management in the context of fisheries management is the area where we're learning more and more and more in terms of our knowledge base as time goes on. Fisheries management traditionally focused on single species. You know, we could tell how many what the numbers were. We could identify how many we should take, and that was the number that we kind of targeted on. And so ecosystem management concepts are relatively new, and I think that number is going to vary from ecosystem to ecosystem and fishery to fishery. Within our evaluation, a big part of the evaluation is looking at, is the fisheries management system going to be effective? Are there MPAs? But it doesn't have that specific numerical requirement yet. And I think as we learn more in our knowledge base, it might eventually become more prescriptive. But I think it's got to be reflective of the particular ecosystem.
I mean, scientists sort of did a back of the envelope thing 15 years ago, saying 20% of the world's oceans, the productive part, should be set aside as no-take marine wilderness. And with the establishment of Northwest Hawaii Monument, the U.S. exclusive economic zone, this 3.6 million square miles, has gone from 0.20th of a percent to about 1%. But it's significant. We're moving in the right direction. California is moving forward and is establishing a whole network of marine reserves that will cover about 15% of California state waters. So the recognition is that, yeah, we need to create wilderness out there, too.
Okay, we're going to do one more question.
Yeah, my name is Tom Anderson. I live here in Aspen. And at one point, there used to be an inland sea here. And so obviously, at one point, the glaciers did melt. I'm wondering, would you be able to tell, because you were saying with the issue of water temperature changing with the glaciers melting, would you be able to, say, check out fossils in the area to see how maybe, you know, the fishery had changed from that point whenever the inland sea was here millions of years ago? Because obviously we've had a glaciers melt and recede, and this has happened before with the oceans warming up. Would there be a way to tell what species were affected or not by actually maybe going there, Dinosaur National Monument or somewhere like, because in this area here in Aspen, there's shark teeth, and you can dig around and find fossils of sea life here in this area.
But, you know, there's probably a way to do that if you're a paleontologist and have an understanding of that, which I'm certainly not. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that the system, the way it is today, we've layered over this fishing industry, which has catching capacity, which basically fisheries management tries to manage inefficiencies, because we have way too much capacity in almost every fishery. And so I think that's one thing that's kind of layered over the top. And then the second thing that's layered over the top are some of the pollution and chemical changes that are occurring because of and again, those are going to be different in different areas. And so the exact impact, you know, it might cause pH changes, might cause some increased toxic loads, and how that might change, again, the species mix. So,
Personally, when I encounter shark teeth, I like them to be 5 million years old.
and I just wanted to add just some comments on optimism. What gets you out of bed in the morning? What's your short optimistic send-off here?
My short optimistic send-off is that I still think that consumers have a big role to play, and that whether they work with our program, pay attention to like the Monterey Bay Aquarium or Environmental Defense advice, looking for good aquaculture products, I think that's all moving us in a positive direction. I think there's still some unknowns out there. I think we still have a big job to do from a communications point of view, but I think I hope we're moving in the right direction.
I think, you know, historically, we collectively, companies and others, governments, have had kind of short-term blinders on this problem and a lot of other environmental problems, and I think what gives me hope is that you're starting to see not a preponderance of these companies and governments, but more and more of them have a longer-term vision of the impacts of what they're doing and their business. And so what was, you know, long-term, meaning 2 or 3 or 5 years for them, is now actually 20, 30, 40 years, and that's, I think, a positive step for this.
And David, you get the last word here too.
I've just met so many watermen and women who, you know, get so much out of the ocean, they want to give something back. So our message, you know, is like that we all be a seaweed rebel, be a marine grassroots part of the solution.
Help the kelp.
Yeah.
Help the kelp. Great.